Hello, everyone, and a very pleasant good afternoon to you, wherever you may be. Bruce Ash and Ed Wilkinson. I'm off to a great start.
Wow.
Welcoming you to a special U of A graduation Mother's Day weekend edition of Inside Track. As always, thank you so much for supporting our great Inside Track sponsors, Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus, Imus Wilkinson Asset Management, and Corazon Cabinets. These are great local businesses you should do business with. Now, before we hear from our special guests today, Bill Kugelman and Brian Davis, I want to share just a few comments on this weekend. Last night, I attended my first U of A commencement ceremony since my own graduation in 1975. Ralsey Miller, my adopted goddaughter, graduated and received her diploma. It was a glorious evening on campus. Ralsey actually graduated in 4 years with a sociology degree, which is very difficult to do these days. Her dad, my best friend, was also a sociology major. Now, he never did anything directly with the degree, and I doubt that Ralsey will either, but he had a great 40-year run as one of Denver's most successful commercial real estate brokers, and later as a college educator. I watched Ralsey grow into a beautiful and poised young woman during her 4 years at the U of A. She's ready for the world. She has a good head on her shoulders and a kind heart. I was delighted to watch her graduate with her mother Mary, her brother Buzz, along with Ralsey's boyfriend Cole and his family, and my wife. I hope Ralsey and her fellow graduates take to heart the admonition of keynote speaker, former NASA astronaut Mae Jemison, to look inward and focus upward to our spiritual selves and God in the things that she does and the other graduates do. Ralsey's dad wasn't here to cherish the evening, but he was, I think, looking down at the festivities, and I'm sure if he was here, he'd be very, very proud of his daughter. And as you know, this is Mother's Day. I'd be in big trouble if I didn't mention that. Mom, Bubaloo, and Nermi, I wish both of you were here today to enjoy your grandsons and great-grandsons on Mother's Day. They are good kids, and there's a little girl on the way in August. Next Mother's Day, there'll be even more to celebrate. Best wishes to my wife, Jane, who's a great mom, and our two daughters-in-law, Ani and Tessa, who are also great moms on Mother's Day. Now, to our guest, special guest, friend and leader, Bill Kugelman, whose personal story of his captivity and liberation we heard again last week as we replayed his 2015 interview with Emil Franzi and myself. Bill is joined by Brian Davis from the Jewish History Museum and Holocaust History Center here in Tucson. Brian is one of the most respected museum executives and curator professionals anywhere in the country. Tucson is fortunate to have his expertise, his knowledge, and creativity, which makes this museum and history center a local treasure. Thank you both for appearing here on Inside Track today. We welcome your calls on topic today for Bill and Brian here on Inside Track. And that's calling on the Imus Wilkinson Live Line at 790-2040. Bill, you just celebrated your 95th birthday. You're 95 years young. How does it feel?
Well, like 95.
You look great. This guy is so dapper. He's wearing this great looking green and blue kind of a Tattersall shirt. He's very, very dapper. And Bill, 95 is, I think, the new 65. Okay, I'm feeling very, very envious. Bill, you've lived quite a remarkable life. Do you ever wonder how you managed to survive when so many others didn't?
Well, it was the will of God. Yeah. And obviously, I had something in me that drove me to overcome difficulties that life and those circumstances provided.
You've made quite an impact on hundreds, if not thousands, of lives since you have come here to Tucson. Can you talk about that, your work for all these years?
Well, at first, I had a problem talking about this, about the Holocaust. I had a problem expressing myself. It was too gruesome for my mind to get into it. And I shut off all talk about it. But eventually, I was talked in by friends to speak up. Why? To make people aware what happens, what happened, and what can happen if, quote unquote, animals are allowed to take over governments and cause havoc to that extent, where millions of people, innocent people, men, women, and children, are slaughtered the most bestial way, whether direct by poison or hunger or whatever the method of the evil ways are.
So all of those years, from the time you had your liberation and came to America, was it a fear of talking about what happened, or were you just not able to express, and you tried to block those memories?
I would say the latter.
Yeah.
You know, the memories of it were so raw, so painful. It was almost a fear of reminiscing.
Yeah, so it really was sort of both blocking as well as fear because of the pain.
Absolutely.
Of what you went through.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was almost physical. The memory of it.
Your friends, Bill, your friends who you've made here in Tucson and elsewhere, who live the same experience as you, you said something about physical pain that you felt. Is that something that you think is a common thread with other friends and colleagues that you've met over the years?
I'll be truthful with you. I honestly cannot speak for anyone else.
Right.
The reaction to whatever pain it is,
right,
varies with the individual.
Right.
I felt, for myself, I can speak, I felt that it was beyond just not wanting to think about it.
Right.
I didn't want to sleep with it. There were people that they spoke about it to get rid of the pain. So they talked it out. I reacted differently. I shut it off.
There's lots of soldiers who've served both in the Second World War and probably lots of wars before and since the Second World War. The things that they saw, the experiences that they had were so horrific, they couldn't They didn't want to see it, feel it, talk about it.
Correct. I believe that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, horror. Living through horror, horror situations, horrible things like that. Yes, different people react different ways.
Right.
I tried to blot it out.
Friends, we're gonna halt right here for a second. We're gonna take a few commercials from our great sponsors, and when we come right back with Bill Kugelman and Brian Davis, we'll hear more about Bill's liberation and coming to America, and the things that he's done. A great man, Bill Kugelman. You're listening to Sidetrack. We'll be right back. We're back. It's Inside Track. We're here with Bill Kugelman, Brian Davis, Eb Wilkinson, and myself. Bill, most people wouldn't blame you if, after what you've lived with, you were filled with hate, and but you're not. I mean, you don't hold a grudge, do you?
Absolutely, a grudge eats on your own soul.
Yes,
that's why I hate is a venom that eats on its keeper, on its carrier. They're welcome to it. Let them hate and let it eat their soul.
See, I think that's one of the most incredible things of somebody who's lived what you've been through, to not feel that hate. And I understand exactly why in what you say. It's almost like therapeutic, you know, in terms of keeping your mental health and your frame of mind the right way. But I mean, it's almost unimaginable to somebody if they weren't through that and experienced what you had.
I don't exactly seek friendship with haters, but I don't hate them. I feel sorry for them in a way.
So, Bill, when we learned your personal story before, when we did your interview back in 2015, we ended the interview. But we weren't able to discuss how you've dedicated yourself to honoring the U.S. Army soldiers who are your liberators for you and your fellow survivors. Can you tell us your honor of the soldiers and what you've done to let people know the goodness that they did?
I'll tell you, I will try to describe the scene of liberation. We were in a big, dark hall with a dirty cement floor, and laying there in the dirt with our dirty rags for clothing, and we saw a couple of GIs come in into that dark, large hall. And there were thousands of people laying on that dirty cement floor. And we crawled up to the two GIs and kissed their dirty boots. There was no, at least for me, there was no strength to express joy. I don't know if I felt joy, if I had any feeling at all. I just know that things changed and I'm alive.
How old were you at that time?
How old? That was 1945. I was 21 years old. The Germans entered Poland when I was 15, and that was the end of my education. And I grew up with the German sword over my head. Without any education, I was right away taken as a slave laborer.
At 15?
At 15. And that lasted till the end of the war.
So, Bill,
you've... At 21.
You've described where you and your fellow captors... or captives lived. It was basically underneath, like a little lean-to almost, with a roof, no floor, exposed to the cold and wet and everything else.
Well, that was the last camp I was in.
Right.
Was an A roof on the ground, and we slept on the ground. I don't remember if there was... what kind of covering there was on the earth that we, there was something between us. Mm. I think there was some sheets of wood or
maybe
whatever.
Maybe wood, yeah.
And that's what we laid on. That's what we slept. That's where we rested. If we got the time off from work.
So how many hours in a typical day would you have worked?
Well, I remember that it was still dark. Many months was still dark when we were leaving. It was dark when we were coming home. Time, I had no watch. I didn't know what time of day. I didn't know what day of the year it was. There were no watches. We had nothing. We were stripped. When we came into Auschwitz,
were you called by your name? Did your captors?
There was no name. There was a number on the arm that you had, and that was your name.
So, if somebody tried to get your attention, how would they do that?
That's a different story. Between the two of us, let's see, you were a prisoner like me,
right?
You called me, if you knew me, you called me by my name. But although they never had any business with us, but if they needed us, we were not to be called by name. We were a thing. Hey, you come here. That's it.
Was there any humanity that you felt from any of your captors at all during your imprisonment?
Not that I did. I didn't. Maybe some people did. I never saw any humanity at all. They did their job as prescribed by the Hitler regime. And even the best of them. He might not hit me, but he wouldn't have anything to do with me. First of all, we didn't have facilities to clean ourselves. So we were filthy. In the wintertime, we cleaned ourselves in the snow. My oldest brother made me do that, made me go out. He didn't survive.
One of the things that struck me the most when in your interview a few years ago was about your brother's death and your regret that you hadn't helped move his body and bury him. Have you come to terms with that after all these years?
I still live with it. I was scared to do it. I understand. Now I understand myself. Mm-hmm. I was scared to see my brother dead. Mm-hmm. It was so tragic for me. Mm. It was so heartbreaking for me that I was scared to see him dead.
Brian Davis, you obviously running the museum, the Holocaust Center, you meet lots of people, Tucsonans here, who've had shared a similar experience in their life as Bill has. Are the stories mostly the same? Is this what you hear frequently?
I would say they're divergent. I mean, they're mostly different. There are similar sort of trajectories for certain people. You know, for example, Jews in Poland, there's a kind of trajectory of ghettoization, expropriation of property, forced labor, concentration camps, you know, certain sites of persecution. But the details, which are, I think, what are most critical to understand, are different. We can understand a kind of, you know, general narrative arc, but when you get into the details of the testimony, that's where I think there's tremendous divergence, as Bill said earlier, you know, in terms of dealing with the aftermath and living with this trauma. It's different from one person to the next. Certainly from within the event, people responded in different ways and had different encounters with different individuals. And there's some kind of relationships that were forged that were inspiring. There's also a certain kind of loneliness and loss of trust in the world that you can hear from survivors often as a kind of theme that emerges quite frequently.
Bill, did you lose trust in humanity, in people after? I mean, you said that you don't hate and you don't hold a grudge, but how difficult has it been for you to trust somebody since your experiences? Well,
right after the war, I'll be honest with you, I was young and I didn't analyze the situation in great detail. I tried to treat people to respond the way they treated me. I tried to respond to them, but I didn't go into, I erased the years of my existence under the German regime. I erased it. Or I tried to erase it, I should say, when it came to my contact with people, with my dealing with my fellow man. I tried not to bring this aspect of my life into both behavior, conversation, treatment of others.
Friends, let's go ahead and take a break right here. Couple more commercials from our sponsors. And when we come back, we're going to talk about VE Day, but also where Bill went from the time of VE Day and living his life and coming to America. You listen to Inside Track. Welcome back to Inside Track. We're here with Bill Kogelman, Brian Davis. We're talking about the next phase of Bill's life after his captivity. Before we talk about how you made it to Sweden and your life there before coming to America, do you remember where you were on Victory in Europe Day, 1945?
I beg your pardon?
Do you remember where you were when you heard that the Germans had surrendered and it was Victory in Europe Day? Yeah.
It was not significant.
For you, sure, because... Yeah.
I was in a both physical and mental state.
Right.
In such a way where a change of situation didn't mean much.
The world events... The world events meant nothing. Your world was your body, probably, right?
My need for food, that's all.
Right. So you eventually made your way to Sweden, where your mother and your sister were. How did you get from the camps, from the time you left the camps, how did, what was your path to get to Sweden?
They organized in a school a matter of fact, it was a school for the SS. They made a camp for us where they kept us there. Why? Because the American forces were afraid that we'll spread disease, because we did have disease
right.
that killed both my right. brother and millions of
right.
others.
Right.
And the American forces, or you know, kept us separated. And then from that camp, we connected our relatives in America. And
was that through the Red Cross or through the State Department?
I think it was the Red Cross. And that we sent a letter to America. So did my mother from Sweden, and that's how we found out that where they were. So we connected with mother.
And you went to Sweden?
We went to Sweden.
And what I thought was incredible before we got started on the show today, Bill tells me, I've never heard this before, although I've heard him sing, that he was a voice student in Sweden after the war. Can you talk about that? You were in a conservatory setting voice.
Yeah. Well, I used to go wherever I could acquire education. And I liked to sing as a youngster. In school, I was part of the orchestra for a while. I was 12, 13 years old, 14 years old. And I played the trumpet. And I liked music all my life.
Still do, I think.
Oh, yeah. And I played the trumpet for a while until the war broke out. And after I came to Sweden, I felt, well, why don't I try it? I went there, and they interviewed me, and they tested me, and they accepted me. And I got voice lessons, and I sang, believe it or not.
Yeah, you can say it.
I don't want to say it.
Okay. All right. so you're in, I think, Mount...
Cut it.
No, we can't cut it. It's okay. It's okay. we're live right now. So you were in conservatory in Malmo, Sweden, and eventually though you did get to the United States. So,
oh, yeah.
About how long were you in Sweden?
7 years.
7 years. So,
seven
approximately
years.
1952 or three.
Yeah.
You came to the United States, and how did you make it here? Did you come by boat? Who paid your way?
No, I went by boat from Germany. Wait a minute. Yes. Yes, by boat we went to Malmö, and that's where we stayed for first Knislinge, then Malmö, and I lived there for 7 years. I almost became a citizen in Sweden, and I would have stayed there, but then I changed my mind. I figured I better go to America.
And how did you physically get to America? Was it again by boat?
By boat.
And who paid for your passage? Do you remember?
No. I think there was a fund. I don't remember whether it was my relatives or there was a fund available.
Maybe, Brian, it was Hyas or some other, maybe the Red Cross, perhaps.
Sure. I mean, for so many with this sort of a story, it's Hyas as
I
an
don't
organization
think
that helped.
That the Red Cross did.
Yeah, probably Hyas then, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. And that organization still exists and still helps people all around the world. So that transition when you got to America, did you come to New York City or another port of entry?
Yes, I came to New York City.
And how long were you there?
In New York City, I lived for 9 years in New York. And I still call New York my home. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Mm-hmm. That's okay. And what did you do?
I feel I'm a New Yorker.
Yeah.
And my grandson.
You have a New York accent, Bill.
That was born. My grandson was born here in Tucson.
Yeah.
He says, I'm a New Yorker. He lives in New York now.
And you married an American woman.
Absolutely.
And part of that was, it was really an effort to distance yourself.
Distance myself from the horrors of the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. And you went into the shoe business.
Well, the shoe business was something that for generations was in my family. As a kid, that's all I knew. The smell of leather, that's all I knew. I watched them manufacture it, the shoes, and I watched them selling the shoes. And as a kid, the store, we had a store in the busiest spot in the city. We lived in an industrial area where it was in Poland, where there were metal processing factories and coal mines.
It was heavy industrial.
It was absolutely heavy industry. And we had a very good location in town, and my people were pretty well off.
And where were your shoe stores here in Tucson?
Oh, I had one store on Broadway. The building is still standing. You want to buy it? I had one store on Broadway, one on 20th. I had actually two on 22nd Street. I moved from one to the other.
What was the name of your store?
Zev's.
Zev's.
G-E-V.
Yeah.
I moved. And one I had on Oracle.
So in Poland, as a kid growing up, your name wasn't Bill. Was it Zev?
Vovic.
Yeah.
And Polish.
So William or Bill would be Vovic in Polish.
So Zev is my Hebrew name.
Right.
Actually, what it means is wolf. That's my real name, Wolf.
Vovic is.
In Polish.
That's sort of an unusual. Well, what's the derivation of Vovic?
I wouldn't know. All I know, that's what they called me. That's it.
So you're 95 now.
Yes.
In 91, you went through a re-bar mitzvah.
No, I did not.
Oh, I thought you did.
No, I don't. Once was enough.
Okay.
All right. Well, look, we're going to take our last break before the top of the hour. Come right back to us after hearing these words from our great sponsors. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Inside Track. Our guest today, Bill Kugelman and Brian Davis. Bill, you've done work for years and years with the local Holocaust Center, within the Jewish community and outside of the Jewish community, telling people about the Holocaust and your experiences, but to educate Tucsonans about this. It's been a life work for you these last several years. You've helped so many people.
Well, the last few years I do only on request by Dr. Brian Davis. I don't go to schools anymore.
Right.
Because it's not the most pleasant way for me to spend my time. Mm. I do it on the where I feel it needs to be done.
Well, that's why we thank you for being here today.
And by request of my dear friend, Dr. Davis.
Well, I can't tell you how happy I was when I reached out to Brian, because I didn't have your contact information, and he told me that you were not just doing well, but was just doing great, and that you were going to be turning 95. And it's great having you here, Brian. The center does so many different things, and it's not just a museum. It's not just a place where people come and look at exhibits. I mean, there are activities and there's programming and there's music and drama and all. I mean, how do you put all of this together? It's an amazing program.
Yeah, we've really reimagined what a museum can be, and we've sort of envisioned this space as more of a cultural center,
yeah.
A place to do community relations work, so building relations between the Jewish community and the broader community. We've really prioritized the educational outreach piece, and in that regard,
how many kids do you think have been touched through the center?
So in the 3 year, we've just been open for 3 years now, more than 10,000 students have come through. And this year, so we've increasingly expanded. So we keep getting more and more schools from Phoenix and across southern Arizona. This year, we actually had a school come from Silver City, New Mexico, and spend the entire day at the museum. And there's a real urgency around that piece, because this is the final moment for them to hear, you know, to have a face-to-face encounter with the living witness of history like Bill. So we're really pushing for schools to come through and have the opportunity for that sort of encounter. And another piece that's really vital to our work is our partnership with the Tucson Police Department. So we formalized an agreement with TPD in the fall of 2016, where now every TPD academy, and that they graduate 4 or 5 classes a year, and the very last thing they do the day before they graduate is spend a couple of hours studying Holocaust history, and specifically the roles that local law enforcement agencies played in the German occupation of various cities. And then they come to the Holocaust Museum, the Holocaust History Center, for a couple of hours to continue that study, and then also to meet with a local Holocaust survivor.
So you've put a face to what happened. I mean, it was always a thing going to Yad Vashem, when you walked into Yad Vashem, seeing these faces of youngsters and adults. They weren't just numbers. These are real people. So how do these police officers, for example, how do they react to the training that they've had at the academy and then seeing this? What are some of the experiences that you've had dealing with these young men and women?
Mm-hmm. I think you hit on a critical point, because one of the, you know, the facets of genocidal violence is the scale of it creates sort of another layer of anonymity, because it's just difficult to imagine what does the loss of 6 million Jewish people look like. But we've really prioritize putting the face and the human voice to it. So as much as possible, we're recording the testimonies and giving visitors an opportunity to have the face-to-face encounter. And for TPD cadets, and we actually expanded that program this year to the Pima County Sheriff's Office as well.
Right. They
do 2 hours of study, and they're studying from sort of the historian's perspective and getting sort of the general contours of the history. But they come to the museum and really narrow in to the human impact and the fact that people who were impacted and their descendants are part of our community, and they make that connection there.
So even on your website, people are able to watch videos and see some of the testimonies. I know Bertie Lefkowitz, who's a friend of mine, who was a hidden child during the Second World War, and she gave a presentation. Alan Langer, whose parents were both survivors. I mean, these are personal life stories that people are able to see, not just by a seminar or some sort of a lecture, but actually can see almost any time they want just by going online.
Right. So some of those testimonies are available online. We're building up that archive and making that accessible as much as possible. And, you know, you mentioned Alan Langer. That's someone who was born in a displaced persons camp after the war in Bergen-Belsen. And increasingly, the baton is being handed off from Holocaust survivors to their children. And I feel like those descendants, even who were born in the immediate aftermath and have that very close proximity and familial connection, carry forward kind of a centerpiece of Holocaust education to make that human connection.
So you also have programming that kind of brings in the Latino community in a meaningful sort of way. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, the Jewish History Museum is located in what was the first synagogue built in the Arizona Territory. It's on South Stone, just south of downtown. And that was built in 1910, so it predates Arizona statehood by a couple of years. Immediately across the street, the Consul of Mexico was established in 1936, and they just moved from that building a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
So we're really kind of carrying on the legacy of, you know, 1936 to 1949, when Temple Emmanuel moved out of that building, where they were neighbors with the Consul of Mexico, and we still have a close relationship with the Consul of Mexico. We also do work with the Jewish Federation's program called the Jewish Latino Teen Coalition that brings together Jewish and Latino high school students, and they make an annual trip to, this year several trips, to the Jewish History Museum and Holocaust History Center.
So the kids today who visit or you know, they get some sort of lecture, you know, in the school on the Holocaust, is the Holocaust real to them? Are you able to make it real for them to really understand? I mean, and how many didn't even know that there was such a thing mm-hmm. that happened before they talked with us?
Yeah, unfortunately, I feel like, you know, Holocaust education has sort of climaxed and is really, unfortunately, at this moment where it's the end of the era of the living witness, it's sort of on a downward trajectory. That's why these sorts of centers are critical. And when we were doing the work to build this Holocaust History Center just a few years ago, some people said, well, there's the Holocaust Museum in D.C. There are two in Los Angeles. Why do we need one here? And the reason is because we can't imagine that all of these students across Southern Arizona are going to D.C. or Los Angeles. But when we have this local resource, it really ensures, and we're doing a lot of work to make sure that this history is part of the curriculum calendar for school districts across Southern Arizona.
Bill, you were to say something.
You asked a very pertinent question. Can you ask of Davis whether you can make someone imagine or see or comprehend the situation of the Holocaust? There is no way in hell that any picture, any description, mm-hmm. any form of explanation can describe the horrors of the situation we were in. I can be the most eloquent man on 2 feet. There is no way I can picture or make you see what went on, the situation that we were in. There is no language for it. There is no, there are no words to describe it.
Well, this has been another fascinating hour. Bill, I can't tell you how much I love you. We've known each other for a long, long time. And your gift to me, to the listeners here and to our community is enormous. Far, far, many years after ultimately when you do leave the planet, people are going to remember who you were, your story, and it makes a heck of a difference. I can't emphasize enough my pride in knowing you and my grateful thankfulness for you coming here again today. And Brian, thank you. You are a consummate professional. We'll have you back on the show to talk more, because there's lots and lots of things that we weren't able to cover in the period of time allotted to us. Bill, I wish you good health and happiness and all of the good things in life. And friends, I hope that you've taken in, I can't really say enjoy, but I hope that you've taken in
appreciate
last week and this week with Bill. These are the times that we live in are still very, very difficult. When Brian comes back, I want to talk about things like BDS. I want to talk about some of the hate crimes that are being perpetrated even now in the last year, these horrific things that have happened in Pittsburgh and in Poway and things that we're doing right here in our own community to prevent these things from happening. There's so much to cover here. And Bill, again, from the bottom of my heart, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, friends, I think we're up right up against it. And until next week for Inside Track, this is Bruce Ash.
And Ev Wilkinson.
Good afternoon.